Chapter 19. The president rose from behind his desk and gave a brief nod as CIA Director Martin Brogan was ushered into the Oval Office for the morning intelligence briefing. The formality of a handshake between the two men had fallen by the wayside soon after their daily meetings began. The slim, urbane Brogan didn't mind in the least. He had narrow, long-fingered violinist's hands, while the tall, 200-pound president had massive paws and a bone-crushing grip. Brogan waited until the president sat down before settling in a leather chair. Almost as if it were a ritual, the president poured a cup of coffee, ladled in a teaspoon of sugar, and graciously handed a large mug to Brogan. The president brushed a hand over his head of silver hair and fixed Brogan with a limpid pair of gray eyes. "Well, what secrets does the world hold this morning?" Brogan shrugged and passed a leather-bound file across the desk. At 0900 Moscow time, Soviet President Georgi Antonov bawled his mistress in the back seat of his limousine on the way to the Kremlin. "I envy his method for starting the day," the president said with a broad smile. He also made two calls from his car phone, one to Sergei Kornilov, head of the Soviet space program, the other to his son, who works in the commercial section of the embassy in Mexico City. You'll find the transcript of the conversations on pages 4 and 5. The president opened the file, slipped on a pair of reading glasses, and scanned the transcript, amazed as always at the penetration of intelligence gathering. "And how was the rest of Georgi's day?" "He spent most of his time on domestic affairs. You wouldn't want to be in his shoes. The outlook on the Soviet economy grows worse by the day. His reforms in the fields and factories have gone down the toilet. The old guard in the Politburo is trying to undermine him. The military isn't happy with his arms proposals and has gone public with its opposition. Soviet citizens are getting more vocal as the lines get longer. With a little prodding by our operatives, graffiti knocking the government are appearing throughout the cities. Overall economic growth has flattened out at 2%. There is a strong possibility Antonov may be forced from power before next summer." "If our deficit doesn't level off, I may wind up in the same boat," the president said grimly. Brogan made no comment. He wasn't expected to. "What's the latest intelligence from Egypt?" the president asked, moving on. President Hassan is also hanging by the skin of his teeth. The Air Force remains loyal, but the army generals are close to throwing in with Yazid. Defense Minister Abu Hamid held a secret meeting with Yazid in Port Said. Our informants say Hamid won't swing his support without assurance of a solid power position. He does not want to be dictated to by Yazid's circle of fanatical mullahs.
"Think Yazid will give in?"
Brogan shook his head. "No, he has no intention of sharing power. Hamid has underestimated Yazid's ruthlessness. We've already uncovered a conspiracy to place a bomb in Hamid's private plane."
"Have you alerted Hamid?"
"I'll need your authority."
"You have it," said the president.
"Hamid is cagey. He may think we're pulling a ploy to keep him out of Yazid's camp. We can supply the names of Yazid's assassin team. Hamid can take it from there if he insists on proof." The president leaned back and stared at the ceiling for a moment.
"Can we tie Yazid to the crash of the UN plane carrying Halakamil?"
"Circumstantial evidence at best," Brogan admitted. "We won't have any concrete conclusions until the investigators wrap up and make their report. For now, the disaster is a real puzzle. Only a few facts have been uncovered. We do know the genuine pilot was murdered. His body was found in the trunk of a car parked at Heathrow Airport."
"Sounds like a mafia hit."
"Almost, except the killer did a masterful job of disguising himself well enough to double as the pilot. After actually taking off the plane, he killed the flight crew by injecting them with a toxic nerve agent known as sarin, turned off course, and abandoned the aircraft over Iceland."
"He must have worked with a team of highly trained professionals," the president said admiringly.
"We have reason to think he acted alone," said Brogan.
"Alone?"
The president's expression turned incredulous.
"This guy has to be one canny son of a bitch.
The finesse and intricacy are trademarks of an Arab whose name is Suleiman Aziz Amar."
"A terrorist?"
"Not in the crude sense. Amar is one of the cleverest assassins in the game. I wish he was on our side."
"Never let the liberals in Congress hear you say that," the president said wryly. Or the news media, Brogan added.
Do you have a file on Amar?
About a meter thick. He's what the trade used to call a master of disguise, a good practicing Muslim who has little interest in politics, a mercenary with no known association with fanatical Islamic diehards. Amar charges enormous fees and gets them. A shrewd businessman. His wealth is estimated at over $60 million. He seldom goes by the book. His hits are ingeniously planned and carried out. All are planned to look like accidents. None can be laid on his doorstep with certainty. Innocent victims mean nothing to him so long as his target is taken out. We suspect he is responsible for over 100 deaths in the past 10 years. His attempt, if proven, to kill Hala Kamil would mark his first recorded failure. The president adjusted his glasses and turned to the report on the air crash. I must have missed something. If he meant for the plane to vanish in the ocean, why did he bother poisoning the passengers? What possible reason could he have for killing them twice? There's the catch, explained Brogan. My analysts don't think Amar was responsible for murdering the passengers.
The president's eyes took on a look of surprise.
You've switched me on a sidetrack, Martin. What in hell are you talking about?
Pathologists from the FBI labs flew up to Thule and performed autopsies on the victims. They found 50 times the sarin required to kill inside the flight crew's bodies, but their tests showed the passengers died from ingesting manchineel in the flight meal.
Brogan paused to sip his coffee.
The president waited, impatiently tapping a pen against a desk calendar. Manchineel, or poison guava, as it's called, is native to the Caribbean and Gulf Coast of Mexico, Brogan continued. It comes from a tree that bears a deadly, sweet-tasting, apple-shaped fruit. Carib Indians use the sap to tip their arrows. Any number of early shipwrecked sailors and modern tourists have died after eating the manchineel's poisonous juices. And your people believe an assassin of Amar's caliber wouldn't stoop to using manchineel?
Something like that, Brogan nodded.
Amar's connections would have no trouble buying or stealing sarin from a European chemical supply company. Manchineel is something else. You can't find it on a shelf. It also works too slowly for a quick kill. I find it doubtful Amar would even consider using it.
If not the Arab, then who?
We don't know, answered Brogan. Certainly none of the three survivors. The only trail, and a faint one, leads to a Mexican delegate by the name of Eduardo Ibarra. He's the only other passenger besides Hala Kamil who didn't eat the meal. It says here he died in the crash. The president looked up from the briefing file. How could he insert poison in the flight meals without being seen?
That was done in the kitchen of the company that caters for the airline. British investigators are checking out that lead now. Maybe Ibarra is innocent. Maybe, for some simple reason, he didn't eat.
According to the surviving flight attendant, Hala slept through the meal, but Ibarra feigned an upset stomach.
It's possible.
The surviving flight attendant saw him eating a sandwich from his briefcase.
Then he knew.
Looked that way.
Why did he risk coming on board if he knew everyone was going to die except him?
As a backup, in case the main target, or targets, probably the entire contingent of Mexicans, didn't take the poison.
The president leaned back in his chair and studied the ceiling.
Okay, Kamil is a thorn in the side of Yazid. He pays Amar to erase her. The job is botched and the plane doesn't disappear in the middle of the Arctic Ocean as planned, but comes down in Greenland. So much for mystery number one. Solid facts for a good case. We'll call it the Egyptian connection. Mystery number two, the Mexican connection, is far more cloudy. There is no obvious motive for a mass murder, and the only suspect is dead. If I were a judge, I'd order the case dismissed for lack of evidence.
I'd have to go along, said Brogan. There has been no evidence of terrorist movements operating out of Mexico.
You forget Topiltzin, the president said unexpectedly.
Brogan was surprised at the cold, furious look of pure anger that spread across the president's face.
The agency has not forgotten Topiltzin, Brogan assured him, or what he did to Guy Rivas. I'll have him taken out whenever you say the word.
The president suddenly sighed and sagged in his chair.
If only it was that simple. Snap my fingers and the CIA obliterates a foreign opposition leader.
The risk is too great.
Kennedy found that out when he condoned the Mafia's attempt to kill Castro. Reagan made no objections to the attempts to get Muammar Gaddafi.
Yes, the president said wearily, if only he had known Gaddafi would fool everyone and die of cancer.
No such luck with Topiltzin. Medical reports say he's as strong as a Missouri mule.
The man is a bloody lunatic. If he takes over Mexico, we'll have a disaster on our hands.
You played the tape made by Rivas? Brogan asked, knowing the answer.
4 times, the president said bitterly. It's enough to provoke nightmares.
And if Topiltzin topples the present government and makes good his threat by sending millions of his people flooding across our border in a mad attempt to recover the American Southwest? Brogan let the question hang. The president replied in a strangely mild tone.
Then I will have no choice but to order our armed forces to treat any horde of illegal aliens as foreign invaders.
Brogan arrived back in his office at the CIA headquarters in Langley and found the Assistant Secretary of the Navy, Elmer Shaw, waiting for him.
Sorry to foul up your busy schedule, said Shaw, but I have some interesting news that might make your day.
Must be important to warrant your personal visit.
It is.
Come in and sit down. Is the news good or bad?
Very good.
Nothing else is going right lately, said Brogan solemnly. I'll be glad to hear something decent for a change. Our survey ship, the Polar Explorer, has been searching for the Soviet Alpha-class submarine that went missing.
I'm familiar with the mission, Brogan interrupted.
Well, they've found it.
Brogan's eyes widened slightly, and he wrapped his desk in a rare display of pleasure.
Congratulations. The Alpha Class is the finest sub in both navies. Your people have pulled off a masterstroke.
We haven't got our hands on it yet, said Shaw.
Brogan's eyes suddenly narrowed.
What about the Russians? Are they aware of the discovery?
We don't think so. Shortly after instruments detected the sunken sub, which, by the way, includes videotape of the wreckage, our ship pulled off the search track and assisted in the rescue operations of the downed UN aircraft. A heaven-sent smokescreen. Our best intelligence from inside the Soviet Navy confirms business as usual. Nothing from the KGB either. And our space surveillance of their North Atlantic fleet shows no indication of dramatic course changes toward the search area.
Odd they didn't have a spy trawler shadow the Polar Explorer.
They did, explained Shaw. They also kept a close eye on our operations all right, monitoring our ship's course and communications by satellite. They left it alone, sitting back and hoping our more advanced underwater search technology would get lucky where theirs failed. Then they banked their expectations on the clear possibility our crew would give away the location through the tiniest of errors.
But they didn't.
No, answered Shaw firmly. Ship security was airtight. Except for the captain and 2 NUMA underwater search experts, the entire crew was briefed to think they were on an iceberg tracking and sea-bottom geology survey. My report on the success of the discovery was hand-carried from Greenland by the Polar Explorer's executive officer, so there was no chance of communications penetration.
Okay, where do we go from here? Inquired Brogan.
Obviously, the Soviets would never allow another Glomar Explorer snatch, and they still have a ship patrolling the area where they lost that missile sub off the East Coast in 86.
We have an underwater salvage job in mind, said Shaw.
When?
If we began putting together the operation now, redesigning and modifying existing submersibles and equipment, we should be ready for salvage in 10 months.
So we ignore the sub or act like it until then?
Correct, replied Shaw.
In the meantime, another event has fallen into our laps that will confuse the Soviets. The Navy needs your agency's cooperation to carry it out.
I'm listening.
During rescue and subsequent investigation of the air crash, the NUMA people working with us in the search accidentally stumbled on what looks like an ancient Roman shipwreck buried in ice.
Brogan stared at Shaw skeptically.
In Greenland?
Shaw nodded.
The word from experts is it's genuine.
What can the CIA do to help the Navy with an old shipwreck?
A little disinformation. We'd like the Russians to think the Polar Explorer was looking for the Roman ship all along.
Brogan noted a flashing light on his intercom.
A sound concept. While the Navy prepares to grab their newest sub, we scatter breadcrumbs down the wrong path.
Something like that.
How will you handle the Roman wreck from your end?
We set up an archaeological project as a cover for an on-site base of operations. The Polar Explorer will remain on station so the crew can give a hand in the excavation.
Is the sub close by?
Less than 10 miles away.
Any idea of her condition?
Some structural damage from a collision with a rise on the seafloor, but otherwise intact.
And the Roman ship?
Our men on the scene claim they've found the frozen bodies of the crew in an excellent state of preservation.
Brogan rose from his desk and walked with Shaw to the door.
Incredible, he said, fascinated.
Then he grinned impishly. I wonder if any ancient state secrets will be found, too.
Shaw grinned back.
Better a hoard of treasure.
Neither man would have bet a dime their humorous exchange was to return to haunt them within the next 48 hours.